Today's Wednesday, January 26th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Carol Van Damme in Washington. U.S. President Biden says he's ready to send troops to Europe if Russia ramps up military action against Ukraine.
I feel obliged to beef up our presence, NATO's presence, on the Eastern Front, Poland, Romania, etc.
Is there an ISIS resurgence in Syria? One analyst says yes.
I think it does demonstrate that there is a resurgence in ISIS in that particular area.
And the Biden administration weighs redesignating the Houthi movement a terrorist group. We'll have these stories and more next. Russia says it's watching with great concern a U.S. move to put 8,500 troops on alert for possible deployment to Eastern Europe amid fears a Russian invasion of Ukraine could be imminent. As VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports, diplomatic efforts continue as the U.S. and NATO boost their military deterrence.
Russia's military buildup along its border with Ukraine and in Belarus is continuing. President Joe Biden told reporters in Washington Tuesday, saying he is now ready to boost U.S. and NATO deterrence in Eastern Europe, but would not send U.S. troops to Ukraine.
I made it clear early on to President Putin that if he were to move into Ukraine, that there'd be severe consequences, including significant economic sanctions, as well as I'd feel obliged to beef up our presence, NATO's presence, on the Eastern Front, Poland, Romania, etc.
Asked if he would consider sanctioning Russian President Vladimir Putin personally, Biden said yes, he would. The United States, Britain, Australia, and Germany have ordered the families of diplomats living in Kyiv to leave Ukraine. Some Ukrainian officials say the move was premature. Oleksiy Danilov is Secretary of Ukraine's National Security and Defense Council.
We must remain calm today. We don't see in reality the situation that is being inflated in the media now.
Asked if the U.S. agrees with Ukraine's assessment, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said this.
Well, no one can get into the mind of President Putin or Russian leadership. We all know that is the case. What we have seen is a range of preparations, including 100,000 troops at the border, bellicose rhetoric, and actions, as we've talked about in here, including false flag operations to try to spread misinformation throughout the region and even the world, setting up the predicate for an invasion.
On Monday, Biden said he had a very good meeting and that the U.S. is in complete unity with key European allies. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz welcomed French President Emmanuel Macron to Berlin Tuesday, and they agreed that Russia would face severe sanctions if it invades Ukraine. Macron said he would speak to Putin on Friday. The diplomatic efforts come as Russia is sending troops and military equipment to Belarus, worrying observers. William Hartung is with the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft.
Well, I think the troops in Belarus, it's concerning. It certainly would position Russia better if they chose to go into Ukraine. Hard to tell at this time if Putin is bluffing or
on Saturday,
to get what he wants without,
Russia's defense ministry published a video of Russian fighter jets taking off for Belarus to take part in joint drills in February. Russia says it is not planning to invade Ukraine despite massing troops and equipment along the border and in Belarus, and is accusing the United States of escalating hostilities. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
In an interview, British Foreign Secretary Liz Truss isn't ruling out sanctions directly against Russian President Vladimir Putin if Russia takes military action against Ukraine.
We're not ruling anything out, and we will be bringing forward new legislation to make our sanctions regime tougher so we were able to target more companies and individuals in Russia.
That was British Foreign Secretary Liz Truss. Russia has accused the U.S. and others of escalating tensions over the issue and denies planning to enter Ukraine, but Moscow has deployed more than 100,000 soldiers near the border. Some protesters in Burkina Faso are turning to Russia for help in the aftermath of this week's coup. Joseph Siegel, director of research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, says he thinks there are several reasons why the coup happened in the West African country, the latest in a string of coups in Africa over the past year.
Immediate trigger is, you know, the growing concern with the spread of the militant Islamist groups from the north. And the increased violence and the displacement that that's causing. But I think that the broader reason is that we're seeing a contagion of coups from the other coups that we've seen in neighboring countries, particularly Mali and Guinea, Chad. And so it has reintroduced the idea among some military actors that they have the right and authority to intervene when they deem the governance situation isn't going in the direction that they feel is sufficiently correct.
We saw that some people in Burkina Faso today and yesterday, they were out actually celebrating after the junta takeover. Can you explain why people are happy to see the overthrow of their leader?
Well, I think we have to be really careful about making those generalizations. Following any coup, you do see some people come on the street, but there are many more who don't come out on the street. And so, yes, every country faces grievances. And these coup plotters will cite those grievances as justification for their extra constitutional action. But in fact, you know, in every instance we've seen in Africa and this recent spate of coups, the coup leaders are simply seeking power. They aren't seeking reform. They aren't seeking to remedy the various challenges that these countries face. And therefore, it's a double whammy on these countries, because not only are they losing their democratization process and constitutional rule, but they're creating a huge distraction from the real challenges that these countries face.
Well, why are some countries like this one, Burkina Faso, people in this country, not everyone, as you point out, but some people saying they're inviting Russia to come in? Why Russia?
Well, the issue of Russia is largely having to do with Mali, where the junta there is trying to prop itself up and so is bringing in mercenaries really to protect its interest. This is despite the fact that there are already nearly 20,000 United Nations peacekeepers on the ground, as well as French and international forces. So it's really a matter of regime protection. In Burkina Faso, there's all sorts of comments being made. The situation is still fluid. We really don't know all that's going on. I think it's important to recognize that this coup in Burkina Faso seems to have been not planned. It seems to have been a mutiny that then degenerated into some individuals seizing power. And so there's a lot that we don't understand. Like I said, there's growing anxiousness, there's growing fear in Burkina Faso because of the surging militant Islamist violence that the country is facing. But there are many other factors involved. Many citizens in Burkina Faso have fought hard to establish their democratic system. It is still, a work in progress. But given their long years of authoritarian rule, most Burkina Faso citizens are not going to be willing to give that up easily.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with me on Wednesday from Washington. The military Islamic State group attempted to break thousands of its fighters out of a Syrian prison on Thursday. ISIS also claimed responsibility for an ambush on an Iraqi military post near Baghdad on Friday, in which 11 soldiers were killed. The apparent revitalization of ISIS comes months after the U.S. withdrew troops from Afghanistan. VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shanawi spoke with Patrick Dunleavy, a senior fellow at the Investigative Project on Terrorism, about whether ISIS is gaining new strength in Syria and Iraq, and if that would embolden its affiliates in Africa.
I think it does demonstrate that there is a resurgence in ISIS in that particular area, coinciding with the U.S. evacuating all its forces from Afghanistan. If you remember, right before the U.S. forces left Afghanistan, the Taliban actually took hold of a prison by the Bagram Air Force Base and released thousands of radical Islamists who were being held by the Americans and by the previous Afghanistan administration. And then we see ISIS, who has been almost forgotten by Western democracies because of their attention being given to the Ukraine and to Russia and to groups like NATO. And slowly ISIS has, since 2019, when we thought that we had defeated them and the caliphate they sought to establish, has slowly but surely increased in strength. And their brazen attack on a prison that coincided with also an attack on a military base in Iraq shows that they are growing stronger and more bold. And this whole attack on prisons is nothing new. If we remember that the actual formation of ISIS took place in a prison in Iraq, where many of the leadership of a group which was to become ISIS was incarcerated. And one of them, its leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, was in there. So jihadists know that prison is not the end of the road on their path to paradise, because they know that at some point their leadership or someone will try to get them out, or they will be able to influence others while they're in prison. I think ISIS has grown in strength, not only in that area, but throughout Africa, Southeast and Central Asia. It's very concerning to many counterterrorism experts.
So could the resurgence of ISIS in Syria and Iraq embolden its affiliates in Africa and the Sahel?
I absolutely think that it will, because as Western democracies such as the United States, the UK, and NATO members are focusing almost all their resources and attention towards Ukraine and Russia, they're overlooking these groups that are in places like Nigeria, Central Africa, Central Asia, where they're able to, again, gain strength, gain fighters, influence, attack. I don't know that ISIS is so much looking to gain land as they did when they initially tried to establish the caliphate, but they are growing in strength in particularly Africa and other places.
U.S. State Department said, "We continue to stand with our partners in the region to counter the remnants of ISIS. While the coalition has severely degraded ISIS' ability to conduct attacks, the group continues its attempts to destabilize the region." What's your take on that?
I think it's a fine statement, but it has no teeth to it. It has no substance to it. I think one of the ways that they continue, the U.S. and other Western democracies continue to, quote, support their partners in this fight is by throwing money at them. For instance, the United States provided monies to train security units in the prisons in Syria that are holding thousands and thousands of ISIS members. And the British government gave over $20 million to reinforce walls and other physical security. But that attack shows that there was some infiltration, particularly with bribing, possible corruption in employees or officials at the prison. So I think resources or the commitment that we have to our partners there, if it's only money, it's going to fail. It's very concerning.
That was Patrick Dunleavy with the Investigative Project on Terrorism, speaking with my colleague Mohammed Al-Shanawi. The Biden administration is considering redesignating Yemen's Houthi movement an international terrorist organization after the group carried out drone and missile attacks on the United Arab Emirates. The Emirati embassy said on Twitter the UAE ambassador urged Biden to restore the designation in response to Monday's strikes on Abu Dhabi Airport and a fuel depot. Reporter Angie Omar spoke to Michael O'Hanlon, who studies regional security issues, as the director of foreign policy research at the Brookings Institution here in Washington. They discussed how the Houthi missile attacks will affect regional security postures and whether designating the Houthis as a terrorist group will change the dynamic.
Yes, but I don't know how much, because as you well know, we've been seeing this sort of thing for a while with the Saudis and the Houthi rebels, and it's sort of become the new normal. No one likes it, And obviously, there's always the danger that, you know, a key building could be hit, a gathering of people, an airliner waiting to take off, you know, a high-rise skyscraper that suffers structural damage and hundreds die. I mean, there are all sorts of really nasty things that could happen. So this is not good, and it's not good when it extends to another country. But it's also not completely out of the blue, because, again, the Saudi-Houthi relationship has been like this for a couple of three, 4 years. So I just see this as sort of a geographic expansion of a dynamic that's already well underway. And therefore, the degree of escalation that this represents is perhaps modest.
U.S. President Joe Biden said on Wednesday his administration is considering redesignating Yemen's Houthi movement as an international terrorist organization following drone and missile attacks on the United Arab Emirates claimed by the group. Would such a designation deter the Houthis and Iranian malign activities in the Gulf?
No, I don't think it would make that much difference, because they don't really depend on the United States, of course, or even the international economic system for much of their money or revenue. And the Iranians, of course, are used to being sanctioned by the United States. And to the extent the Iranians and the Houthis are collaborating, and that the Houthis may get some resources from the Iranians, that's not going to be affected by U.S. sanctions. And moreover, this kind of a designation doesn't lead to any automatic new intensification of American economic or military pressure. I should say it indicates some limited amount of further economic pressure, but again, we didn't have much interaction with them even before. And it doesn't say anything about what kind of steps we may take in the security realm. So it means something, but it doesn't mean a lot. And I would be surprised if it made much of an impact.
That was reporter Angie Omar speaking with Michael O'Hanlon of the Brookings Institution. U.S. health authorities are curbing the use of antibody drugs that studies show are ineffective against the Omicron variant of COVID-19. AP correspondent Mike Gracia reports.
The Food and Drug Administration is revoking emergency authorization for COVID-19 antibody drugs from Regeneron and Eli Lilly because they are unlikely to work against the Omicron variant. Omicron now accounts for nearly all coronavirus infections in the U.S. The antibody drugs have been promoted by some Republican governors, and then-President Donald Trump was treated with Regeneron's antibody combination after he tested positive for the coronavirus in 2020. There are alternate therapies, including two new antiviral pills from Pfizer and Merck, and an antibody drug from GlaxoSmithKline, but all three are in short supply. The FDA says if the antibody drugs prove effective against future variants, it could reauthorize their use. Mike Gracia, Washington.
Repeated COVID-19 testing of millions of Beijing residents is starting to test the patience of some in the Chinese capital as the city clamps down on the virus ahead of the Winter Olympics. A third round of mass testing for the 2 million residents of the Fengtai district got underway on Wednesday. Residents bundled up against the wind as they waited to be tested with a temperature around freezing. The Vatican is defending the record of Pope Benedict XVI on fighting clergy sexual abuse after an independent report faulted how he dealt with four cases of abuse while Archbishop of Munich in Germany. The Holy See's editorial director noted that Benedict was the first pope to meet with victims of abuse, and that Benedict issued strong norms to punish priests who raped children and ordered the church to pursue a path of humility in seeking forgiveness for those who committed crimes. A German law firm released the lengthy report last week. It had been commissioned by the German church. Lebanon signed a deal Wednesday to import electricity from Jordan via Syria with the goal of reducing chronic outages. The agreement the country's energy minister signed with his Jordanian and Syrian counterparts is expected to give Lebanon 2 extra hours of electricity each day, which doubles the supply currently provided by the cash-strapped government. A California city voted Tuesday night to require gun owners to carry liability insurance in what's believed to be the first measure of its kind in the United States. The San Jose City Council passed the measure by an overwhelming vote, despite opposition from gun owners who say it would violate their Second Amendment rights. Mexican journalists on Tuesday started nationwide protests to denounce the recent murders of 3 reporters, demanding an end to the impunity that has often characterized the killings of their colleagues. Reuters correspondent Brian Wood reports.
3 journalists have been killed in Mexico in the last 2 weeks. The latest, Lourdes Maldonado, shot sitting in a car over the weekend in the northern border city, Tijuana. Mexico is one of the world's most dangerous countries for journalists. Nearly 150 have been killed in the last 20 years, according to an advocacy group, Article 19. Maldonado's killing inspired a nationwide journalist-led protest on Tuesday. In Mexico City, demonstrators held a vigil and signs that read, "You can't kill the truth by killing journalists."
I'm here with a lot of grief because more than 100 journalists have been murdered in the last couple of years, no matter how many times we've protested.
In a statement, Article 19 said, "It is a matter of urgency that state and federal authorities prevent attacks, protect journalists when they are the victims, and investigate crimes committed against the press with due diligence." The country's president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, has been criticized for not acting to protect reporters. His government said they'd work to solve Maldonado's killing in hopes of preventing more like it.
That was Reuters correspondent Brian Wood. Voice-activated virtual assistant technologies such as Siri and Alexa are becoming increasingly common around the world. But in Africa, with its many languages, most people are at a digital disadvantage. To address the problem, some African researchers are creating translation tools to recognize and promote indigenous languages such as Yoruba. Timothy Obiezu in Abuja has the details.
Yoruba language teacher Oluwafemi Awosonia resumes a day's classes with his students. He has been teaching the language for 10 years but says he often struggles to migrate his class modules to an online student's blog site he created because there is no speech recognition technology for Yoruba.
Yoruba language is a language that has to do with signs. Yeah, it comes with a lot of signs on the top, below, you know. I need to go extra mile. When typing my notes, I have to first type on Microsoft Word. And even when I type on Microsoft Word, it gives me this highlighting, like the words are not correct.
Awosanya spends several hours manually editing and correcting his notes before uploading them to his blog. He says despite technological advances in Africa, languages like Yoruba, one of the most commonly spoken in Nigeria, remain neglected, affecting his students.
Limit knowledge. It limits the exhibition of knowledge. There are things you might wish you want to educate the student on. There are things you want to exhibit in the classes.
More than 2,000 distinct languages are spoken in Africa. Researchers say two-thirds of the native speakers miss out on emerging technologies due to language limitations in the tech world. Nigerian writer and language advocate Kola Tubosun says the issue threatens Africa's technological future. He has since been trying to promote inclusivity for his native Yoruba tongue. He created an online Yoruba dictionary as well as a text-to-speech machine that translates English to Yoruba. He said the initiative was partly inspired by his grandfather, who could not read or write in English.
If a language doesn't exist in technology space, it is almost as if it doesn't exist at all. That is the way the world is structured today, in that if you spend all your time online every day and the only language you encounter is English or Spanish or Mandarin or whatever else, it tends to define the way you interact with the world. And over time, you tend to lose either the interest in your own language or even your competence.
Tubosun, who advocates for including African languages in technology, says the tech giants are starting to pay attention, even though the gap remains very wide.
There are a lot of obstacles. Some languages are not written down at all. Some don't have scripts. Some have scripts, but don't have so many people using the languages or writing them in education or using them in daily conversations.
Language experts say it will take a long time before African languages are widely adopted in voice-driven technology. In the meantime, researchers like Tubosun and Awosanya will be working to adapt the Yoruba language for technology users. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of managing editor Kate Dawson, producer Nadia Taha, and the entire production team, thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Carol Van Damme in Washington.